This is Channel One Over. This is Channel One Over. And the end of the visit with Suzanne Veldhuis, talking about the Divinity School address, Friday in my office, the 25th of March, April 1969. This is the end of the visit, just a little bit left of the visit with Suzanne Veldhuis, talking in my office about the Divinity School address, Friday afternoon, the 25th of March, 1969. Now, this is Channel One Over. This is Channel One. I said in the advanced composition class I had learned that the youngsters could, with me creating a little world for them, open up, and when someone read a paper, to inquire what that person knew and was interested in, and not combat them.
You know, our people wouldn't class with them, but they would inquire. Now they'd say, here's a girl who brought up abroad, and her parents had these views, and they'd want to hear you out.
Exactly, yeah.
But that's not done.
I know. Well, see, number one, most people are so involved with their own little world that they don't have the freedom, the desire, or the interest in really seeing what other worlds are like. I sometimes meet people who've come over from Europe, and I feel a bond of oneness with them. Those people are now passing through as tourists in America. And we talk about things either in the home life or things in the world from such a different viewpoint. It's utterly refreshing. You just feel free and natural. Whereas, like, I walk across campus, I talk with friends, with people who've been brought up here in America, and there's some definite deep element that does not exist between us that should. We're just not one. We've had...
I think to be... have a tremendous influence, I mean, after his lifetime in the school. I think he had a tremendous influence. And I'll tell you what I think it was. I think the theological view is limited in its appeal. And... it had that basic appeal of this, of the perception, the intuition, the spirit, that enabled a person to inquire.
Yeah. Now, didn't Franklin, to an extent, have this too? Like, you look at Franklin, and many of the virtues that he valued, or the virtues that he ascribes to poor Richard, were qualities that his parents either displayed themselves or instilled in him. And I think it's often the case with other people. What is Emerson's background like? What were his parents? How did they bring him up? See, I'm not familiar with this.
I'm not either. They were, he kept had a, he was brought up in a religious
environment too. Yeah.
I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could absorb just a little while, leave our minds uncluttered, and not filled with so much knowledge, and see what Emerson and the others are about.
Relating material,
yeah.
Memorizing it,
yeah.
Placing the facts in your head, not having time to meditate or digest them or order them according to any type line that you see fit.
Yeah.
And that's wrong. It to me, my education, it's been almost useless. I've accumulated perhaps a vast reservoir of knowledge in the scientific area, but that's vain.
It
doesn't help me live a better life.
No, it just makes you useful.
Yeah, well.
You can take my blood pressure.
Oh, dear, dear.
You know,
that's exactly the way it is with Thoreau. He went out to the woods, and it's there that he summoned up these great ideas, and he sat and pondered and thought. This is what each one of us needs. Many times I've wished I just had a couple of months just to go and think out what I thought about life.
Yeah.
But there's no time for it.
Yeah.
You're wrapped up in this whirlwind of life here in America.
That's right.
And that's the end of this tape with this very articulate, charming girl, provoked by the occasion, by the Divinity School address. This was on Friday, following our discussion of it in class on Monday, where we tried to get into it. My first experience with the Divinity School address. This is on Friday, the 25th of April, 1969, in my office with Suzanne Veldhuis. in my office, and this is Channel 1 over, around 75. Now, this is the first discussion I ever taped of the Scarlet Letter, open, without studying or reading the bibliography or without any guides at all. This is just unreflected, raw reactions to the Scarlet Letter in class on Friday, the 25th of April, 1969. Friday, the 25th of April, 1969. Just raw discussion of the Scarlet Letter. And I had said to them, just read it and let me know what you think about it now before we discuss it, before you read articles on it. Oh, I'm not sure that this little tape is worth setting down. It was all in good nature, I'll say that. Boy, and we talked and parried and everything. And then at the last, I laid it down and put down the Emersonian viewpoint as an approach to it. First, Florence spoke. I was standing in the aisle, and I just said to her, say something. So she brought up Hester's attitude when we first see her.
You might say poise in the face of all her adversity, which seemed to persist from the time she came out of the prison door, and her poise at all when she was being sort of chastised and ridiculed by people, and her inward strength.
Her poise? I don't remember any woman mentioning her poise before.
I'm just picking it up.
Her poise. Then it's no. You couldn't give even more respect to her. You know, if like she was married, she could have gotten divorced. So I guess that's my. So I guess that's my historical.
And you wouldn't have an album.
Why she didn't stay in this community that was chastising herself. It seemed to me that if I was in her position, I would leave and get away and go back to England where no one knew what happened.
Yeah.
But yet they explained it that she wanted, because she committed her sin in this town, she wanted to repent for it here. But it didn't seem to make sense to me why she stayed there.
It said Dinsdale.
Well, it also said Dinsdale, but it said she wanted to serve her punishment there too. But it
arranged finances, and she had no income.
Mace.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tom.
I think in regard to her haughty, that they did say something about how, you know, you didn't say haughty, what did you say?
Poise.
And but they do say haughty specifically in the book.
Yeah.
Which certainly is, I think, something you associate more nearly with poise than you'd expect a young woman to sort of just dissolve and some emotional heat before a crowd like that, rather than being able to stand there and do nothing more than blush.
That's right. Now, did you notice that when you were reading it?
Right.
That's right. So that's curious, isn't it? That is indeed.
Very few women would be having
this
ability.
What's your name? Suzanne.
Seems like very few people would have the ability to stand there and face that kind of shame.
Yes.
I mean, it just, even to imagine it to me would.
Well, what was her reaction? Just poise?
No, she pride in a way, and defiance a little bit, but she kind of took refuge in memories, you know, her mind wandered.
Look at the book, see what she said. What's your name?
Raven. I think it was kind of a defense mechanism for her to go to the extreme of being kind of defiant and kind of, you know, like if she didn't put into her mind just to not let these people bother her, she would have broken down, like they say. But I think it was a defense mechanism that she just goes and just decides that she's going to just not let these people bother her.
Well, now, before Frankel, you don't have defense mechanisms.
Before who?
Frankel.
Victor.
Victor Frankel. You don't have defense mechanisms back in this time. They've got no
defense. Yes, it's not defined. I mean, it's still with eight. If somebody's mean to you, you're gonna go to the extreme not to let them bother you. I mean, it's not defined as a defense mechanism, but it's still there.
No, that'll be reading psychology into Hawthorne that he doesn't know about.
About human nature.
Well, I'd try to read the book, see what he said.
But still, every human, no matter how, when, or where, still has this defense mechanism that's born within him. It may not be as clearly defined in one person as another, but it's still there.
Leonard? How do you pronounce it?
Leonard.
Still there?
I think it's in every person.
Did you look in the book?
Yes.
It says, in our nature, however, there is a provision, alike marvelous and merciful, that the sufferer should never know the intensity of what he endures by its present torture, but chiefly by the pang that rankles after it.
Yeah, but that's not a defense mechanism.
It's not. And then she said, with almost a serene deportment, therefore Hester passed through this portion of her ordeal.
Well, it's nice when we sort of wrangle over it. It kind of brings it out, doesn't it? Now, that's not what you had in mind, what she did.
I thought it was... Maybe it happens more with girls, but they'd be catty or something like that. So you kind of don't let it bother you, and you don't really... If you let it bother you, it can really, you know, kind of make you fall apart, but you won't let it bother you or something.
So you fall apart later?
No, you just don't let it bother you. But you could if you were really sensitive to it and let it.
I didn't hit it at that time, but it hits you later. When did it hit her?
That's when I think it hits her. When she rips the skull in and off her dress and takes the hat off in the woods.
Oh, way along the middle of the book?
Mm-hmm.
Year or so later?
I think that's when it finally hits her.
Gee Willikins, that's a long time. That's too late.
Is that too late for it to hit you? You can take so much and then you can't take any more.
When she was in the prison talking to her husband is when
that's
she
same
got
thing.
All upset. I mean, really collapsed,
mm-hmm.
sort of.
Yeah.
The way she couldn't find him because she was so... depleted emotionally. I mean, she's just completely worn out, and she couldn't find him, so she gave in to whatever he is. And that seems to me when the whole reaction to the shame and the agony.
Well, now let's see. Still, even so, brief, frankly, with this, I think it's Hawthorne's ambiguous. This Scarlet Letter is ambiguous, and the reaction to it is more likely to be curious and. Correct. Yes, in fact. Let's move on to something else.
I wanted to say that when Hester goes on the pillory, that she was impulsive and passionate by nature, but had prepared herself for this ordeal. And I mean, that is sort of a contradictory thing. That the impulsive, passionate person is usually not the type who would be so inclined to prepare herself for an ordeal. I mean, she does, according to the story, go on to act as if she were prepared.
Yes, so...
I think he's being ambiguous there.
Ms. Mays, this is sort of continuation of the other. Her poise there in the face of difficulty, or the shock, is carried over to the pillory where she fortifies herself. As he says, she's an impulsive person.
There's this passion, this feeling that more or less, which part of the nature earlier, is replaced by thought. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but that's way over there. Now, where are we?
You talked
about repentance. That's the reason I wrote that up there on the board.
I don't think. Lord
now, her penitence, that's pretty considerable, isn't it?
What's the name?
I don't know, maybe it denotes a certain childlike simplicity of the society in which she was in. Because if she had any self-responsibility for what she had done, I don't think she would have considered doing such penitence. I think she would have rather been a martyr and had someone else punish her as a child would wish to do. A sort of catharsis is when somebody punishes a child, the child can look to them and say, you have punished me, therefore now I am free because you have been a scapegoat for my sin or my crime.
Well, there's a right smart punishing going on, isn't there? They tied her and bite her and insult her, don't they?
But they're not sadists. They're more afraid. They're being punished more than she is.
You're
good deal of the suffering, of penitence in there.
She does too. So sad. Oh. Remember, in her town.
Yeah.
Rather than being.
Yeah.
She and she almost wished that at that time they would mock and scorn her. And then she would feel freer to suffer as she was. But this way, they weren't really doing anything. They were just standing there looking at her. And that was the tormenting thing, and they openly mocked her.
I don't understand that. Now, what's the point of that?
What was your point? I love cats.
Suzanne, what's
your point? My point was the same as hers. Simply that if the crowd had openly punished her.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they did in a sense because they forced her to wear the
clothes. Like a child. If they could have openly punished her like a child, then she
could have. Yeah, she could have felt that she'd be released from.
But they were sullen.
Yeah, and they didn't do it
so.
With breath. Yeah.
My comment was something about what she was saying about. That she wanted them to mock her so she could be stronger, so she could defy them. You know, this is what you were saying. So she'd get strength from their saying, haha, you were naughty. Then she could go, well, see, I'm really good. I'm standing up here and being brave.
Completely seriously, you know. I mean, they didn't laugh at her. They didn't make fun of you like you might do now, or throw eggs at her or something like that. And that made you.
But isn't this more the attitude of a parent punishing a child?
Yeah. Now you're getting ready to pass on. You thought too much about these things. Yeah.
I was just plain left wondering whether she was trying to punish herself the more by the change in her appearance, or whether she was trying to just blend into and be inconspicuous when she goes from being covering her beautiful hair and all this sort of thing. And I still haven't decided which I think she was doing or Hawthorne intended for. Starts dressing very drab and so forth, and I'm wondering if she's doing this to punish herself still further, or if she's doing it to just plain be less conspicuous, or the very drabness of her garb seemed to point out the beauty of her A that she had. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what was her
well, I don't remember
she was
saying
trying to
anything
herself.
Like that.
It does.
The book's
got
to say it.
It does say it. It does.
You mean the drabness of her garb?
Right, and that she covered her hair.
All right, then you will vote me down.
Well, it's like we're showing. She, I think she thinks that she tries to take all these mortification of herself, like Dimmesdale does with the scourge, because she still cherishes the faith and the love. So she tries to, you know, make herself feel like she's, you know, really tempted. But she's not. She knows that.
You see, mortification.
Yeah.
Mortification. Oh, that's just charming. That's just delightful. Mortification. I'll write that on the board.
By counting all these joys or pleasures that she might have as sins, it's kind of, she was trying to lessen the sin that she still kept within her heart, that her love for Dimmesdale. She never rejected that.
Yeah.
She tried to mortify her soul or her body, just like Dimmesdale did with the scourge, to make the real sin less apparent to herself.
That's what I do. Layton?
I'd like to get some ideas on the symbolism, what people think the difference in contrast to the way she dressed. She always made fine garments and all for her daughter.
Well, that's the same thing, isn't it? Wouldn't that be the same thing?
Yeah, that she only allowed herself one outlet.
Yeah.
And the rest of she tried to cover it for
her. Yeah.
Well, then you think her daughter is an outlet to, you know, looking and watching her daughter be so beautiful.
Well, the embroidery. And the garments that she embroidered.
Well,
for
what
the
I was getting at was the different appearances of the two, not she sat down and made the clothes, but I see what you mean.
Yes, it'd work out that way. I can see that. That'd just be an extension of it. Basic character is weakness.
I follow what they're saying, but they something that I don't quite understand. That she didn't sew anything for herself to deny herself the pleasure of wearing beautiful garments to punish herself more, but she still had the pleasure of embroidering all these other garments for the governor and all the other people in the town. So is it that she just doesn't get pleasure from actually wearing the garments? Is it because she must get pleasure from sewing them?
That's what I mean. I read this. To Hester Prynne, it might have been a mode of expressing and therefore soothing the passion of her life. Like all other joys, she rejected it as sin. This means that delicate needlework.
Yeah.
This morbid meddling of conscience with an immaterial matter betokens, it is to be feared, no genuine and steadfast penitence, but something doubtful, something that might be deeply wrong beneath.
That's an ambiguous statement, really. What we're trying to say is, I'll help hold on. We're talking about here, see, she has the conflict that Miss May talked about. She has the pride and the, what else did you call it, the passionate nature and the...
Impulsiveness.
That was her basic nature. But in light of what happened, you see, society has put a stamp on all that, and it's desperation, or what is it we're talking about, mortification that she can express and live. Can that, you say it simply?
I wish I could, but I it's hard to rephrase it because it's not really set in my mind yet.
Yeah.
I haven't thought it over enough.
Because he never would share this shame with Hester, and he was equally as guilty as she was. He kept it within himself, and he wouldn't openly confess his sin. Of course, he got up there on the pulpit, and he told that he was a vile sinner and all that, but that made the people like him even more. Because...
That's ironical, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He confessed, he tried to confess, the next thing to confess. And they took it for...
Yes, but he, like Suzanne said earlier, that he knew how they would take it. He knew that they would, it would just increase their...
He was so embedded inside himself that he really wasn't thinking about how the people would take it as much as he just wanted to purge himself. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me.
He was so mixed up and...
He just wanted to...
At cross purposes.
He told them to forget it.
At cross purposes, and
given many opportunities to confess by Chillingsworth, near the incident when Chillingsworth got the herb from the grave, you know, he mentioned the man who died without a name on his tombstone.
Yeah.
You know, and he said, "Well, you know, not everyone has to die with these things in their heart."
Yeah.
And that was a good chance to confess.
Yeah.
So he must have been a little weak not to confide in anyone.
Well, it's representative.
Or he's strong, but he could keep his mouth shut.
We're telling where it's representative of strength, I guess. Yeah.
You can't both ways. Some people can't keep a secret.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, everybody.
I feel he's basically strong. Stronger than all the other people there.
Are you just being contrary?
No, I'm not. I think it's because he didn't have to go through this catharsis that Hester did. He could accept his punishment as his own responsibility.
Yeah.
It's a lot more difficult to do that than to confess.
He didn't complain.
No.
But Hawthorne represents him as just falling apart. There's just no denying that, you see.
True.
He can't hardly walk. What do you mean physically?
Well, you don't like to bring up, you said psychology so much with Hawthorne, but talk about psychosomatic illness, he had them all. you know, and I think since his guilt, he probably kept him from eating, and he was just withering away bodily. I don't know
his
about his soul.
Spirit was
spirit
wearing down his body?
His body. Yes. Just like people who are sad and oppressed, they don't.
Yeah.
I think the body and the spirit are together. And one goes, the other does somewhat.
Well, it's represented that way, isn't it? It
appears to be.
I don't guess Hawthorne had used the term.
Well, probably not, but that's the way you can look at it now.
Uh huh. Please.
Well, I thought he was weak and he watched him transcend into somebody that was strong at the end when he, you know. Confessed at the very end to looking when he died.
Mm-hmm.
But now I question whether that was strength or just selfishness because he didn't want to die with his own conscience.
Yeah.
So I think he was weak throughout the book, because, like, to me, he, like, he stood up there in the night with Pearl and Hester, and yet she said, "Will you confess tomorrow?" Something like that. And he said, "No, not yet." I think he was tormented by whether to confess or not, but I think he was weak because he was afraid of what would happen, you know, in the community, if people knew, and so he didn't have really anything to lose when he confessed in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was dying anyway, except for his self-interest to make him feel better.
Well, he was going to flee. They were going to flee. Hester perked him up.
Mm-hmm.
Give him a shot. And he didn't. Circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
He saw he couldn't flee, that his reputation would follow him. Isn't that it? The ship captain,
mm-hmm.
the crew, and all. Yeah.
Well, some of it sort of reminded me about what Emerson said, in that I think it was in the Divinity School address about sort of like goodness being its own reward, and when you do evil, it's sort of its own punishment. When he was talking about that, I think it was in with the essence of virtue or whatever that was, and he said when you do something good, it sort of ennobles you, and that's kind of the reward, and when you do something bad, you feel rotten about it, and you sort of punish yourself for it. And I think that he probably suffered, you know, more than anybody else did, because he was like punishing himself, and like he didn't confess and then at least feel good. Well, you know, at least it was out in the open, at least he had confessed. You know, he had, like, first of all, you know, he had the deed, and then he had the not confessing either to it. And like, lots of times you punish yourself a lot worse than somebody else would, and so he suffered more than anybody else probably by having it locked up inside of him, and by just, you know, being the one to punish himself.
That's good.
Evil follows man. Wasn't that the rest of that quote in Emerson, sort of?
Now, I lay out the Emersonian approach.
Autobiography. You see, I could study up on all those things and read the bibliography and come in here and report to you about them. I think that's a seminar method. I'm not sure that it's even a good seminar method, unless the report brings forth a considerable amount of discussion. We wound up in that. We looked around and we saw what was not in the autobiography. Franklin is a scientist, is not, and all those scientific interests of his. Then Franklin, as the representative of the Enlightenment, I read you those passages, you know, from his time at Passy, is not in the autobiography. And then I suggested to you that you could consider that in the autobiography, what Franklin actually does is represent himself as Poor Richard. Now, I gave you this to go on from this little Way to Wells that's in your book. Now, that is Poor Richard. That is this point of view of prudence, and that was devised and worked out in the 18th century. And Franklin is one of the, that movement. Now, you see, what you called on to do, as I said to you that day when I performed for you or spoke, you called on to do is get hold of the material, to get hold of it and use it. You look into this Way to Wealth and you work it out, you line it out, and you get hold of it, and you see that what it does, Franklin, in effect, is giving you an analysis of that whole point of view, a whole school of thought that went generally by the name of prudence. And I said to you that I always felt half-baked, and that what I always wanted to do, needed to do, thought I needed to do, was carry on from Franklin, use his terminology, and give it a present-day application. I think if one did that, he would see some monstrous things,
some monstrous things. And what Thoreau says about those farmers who he sees pushing that house and lot down the highway, oh, I think you'd find just case after case of that. We could stay together long enough to get our thoughts together. Well, now, you're approaching The Scarlet Letter. It's one of the classics. From what you said, from what we said, you said already, you see that it doesn't hold together. And if it says what you say it says, it's not worth reading. You're not interested in penance for sin and overcoming it. You're not interested in that. You have to consider that you misread, but that you are expert readers. Now, you're not scholars, but you're expert readers. And here you're working together, and that ought to help. There could be something basically wrong with The Scarlet Letter. What I think it is that Hawthorne is using an old 17th century story and trying to say something modern. And he can't do it. Now, what I suggest to you, I'm not going to lecture to you. What I suggest to you is that you use Hawthorne, Thoreau, and Emerson as an approach to it. Read The Scarlet Letter in the light of Hawthorne and the light of Thoreau and Emerson. Well, now, I can give you the... Let me just lay it out very briefly. I can just give you the touchstones of it. You see, think of... Think of Hester as the scholar that he's talking about in American Scholar and the genius that he's talking about in The Severed Lions. I don't think the Divinity School address is quite helpful. I mean, it doesn't help too much. Now, you see, right off, you say, well, Thoreau went to Walden in order to clear his mind. Hester didn't do that, but she did. And furthermore, he stayed only 2 years, and she stayed 7. Good did it do? Well, now, you don't want a moral answer to that. You want an Emersonian answer to it. What good did it do Thoreau? It didn't make him strong. It didn't make him moral and virtuous. Emerson talks only about illumination, perception, intuition. This clash with society, Hester, a scholar, the scholar. That's just the main outline. But you see, actually, it's not quite that clear cut. Because Thoreau, as Canby says, was hurting. He was hurting, seriously.
Yeah, but in the sense of guilt. I mean, he didn't, I don't think he was suffering any spiritual guilt like Hester was.
Hawthorne doesn't say that she felt guilt.
I think that's the topic of the whole book, is this, the idea that Hawthorne is talking about the way human beings approach this guilt. We all suffer. Some of us suffer in different ways, and I think Hester is the example of suffering guilt, religious guilt, spiritual guilt.
It doesn't say that Hester suffers guilt in any sense.
She does, because she repents when she, an example illustrating this is when she goes about trying to do all the good deeds she can do. She goes about, she's like a Salvation Army worker. She's going around to all, you know, all the different homes and doing whatever she can do to sort of, in other words, I think she feels, looks at herself as if she's a martyr. And she's got to repent, so she goes, she does everything she can do to, you know, relieve this burden of guilt that she has on her soul.
She does that in one paragraph in the whole book. As in the case of Franklin, you had to work it out. Now, in the case of Hawthorne, you have to work it out. And I don't know that I can work it out. All I do is say to you that what we have said about this book this morning is it wouldn't be worth reading. I suggest to you that you use an Emersonian approach. That is, approach it as part of Emerson's time. And they were neighbors. And you know that the saying is, it's in the books, Hawthorne said it. He had to move away from Emerson when he wrote the Scarlet Letter so he wouldn't be over-influenced. He couldn't look close to it.
Yes,
now, see, I put it a little bluntly. You see, what he says, I don't know, I may be on the wrong tack. You see, I just figure we've known each other forever, and it is, we've got no disagreements. And no grounds for disagreement. And I speak to you too strong sometimes. It's almost like he said of the in the Divinity School address that instruction does not come on this subject. It has to be, what was that word? Let me find that. That's the instruction. The instruction. I'm afraid I don't. I'm not any good enough at stuff. I think it's more provocation, and it's. I didn't mean to do that. See, I just meant to state it. That's all I meant to do. Just state it. And we work on it. Now, on the strength of Dimmesdale, or the weakness. You see, he's represented in the last part of the book, an election sermon, as doing a magnificent thing. A man who's weak physically, as Hawthorne represents him, couldn't do that. He simply couldn't do that. It's overstated. And he just can't fall apart just that close after he performs in that magnificent way. It's a century of rhetoric, of oratory, words, and Hawthorne, in a way, puts him along with Daniel Webster as a spellbinder, you might say. Certainly, it's not an 8th, 17th, 16th century, 17th century sermon. I brought one. It's a sincere convert. A sincere convert, and it's by Thomas Shepard. And it was preached and then set down. See, in those days, they preached sermon and published it, and you bought it. You bought it, just one little, see, Franklin, anybody would print it off for you. And then people bought it and gave it for a Christmas present, birthday present. Now, here it is.
that those that are saved are very few, and that those that are saved with very much difficulty. Straight is the gate, and narrow is the way that leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. Matthew 7:14. Here are two parts. One, the paucity of them that shall be saved. Few find the way thither. Two, the difficulty of being saved. Straight and narrow is the way and gate unto life. Here arise two doctrines. One, that the number of them that shall be saved is very small. Luke 13:24. The devil hath his drove and swarms to go to hell as fast as bees to their hive. Christ hath his flock, and that is but a little stock, since God's children are called jewels in Malachi 3:17, which commonly are kept secret in respect of the other lumber in the house. Hence they are called strangers and pilgrims, which are very few in respect of the inhabitants of the country through which they pass. Hence they are called sons of God, 1 John 3:2, of the royal blood, which are few in respect of common subjects. But see the truth of the point in these two sayings. First, look to all ages and times of the world. Secondly, to all places and persons in the world, and we shall see few men were saved. One, look to all ages, and we shall find but a handful saved. As soon as ever the Lord began to keep house, and there were but two families in it, there was a bloody Cain living and a good Abel slain. And as the world increased in number, so in wickedness, Genesis 6:12, it is said, all flesh had corrupted their ways, and amongst so many thousand men, not one righteous but Noah and his family. And yet in the ark there crept in a cursed somebody. C.J.M. 17th century. If I could just look severe enough up here. And I saw on a little film strip one time a picture of it. And in those little chapels or little churches that they had. And you know, the churches then were so small. So small. I don't think the whole room there, you see, was as big as this. And the pulpit was way up high. And the effect of it, you see, way up high. The effect of it, you see, was that the Lord is looking right at you. Now that's it I got. Now I'm not sure. So that fear, the fear of the Lord. Now you got to consider too, that Hawthorne is writing a 19th century message, and they're not interested in sin in the 19th century. They had boomer girls then. Anything. Have this little piece of literature that you've already broken in and just examine it with something you know will come out and put it in a whole new light and something you can live with. It might, you see, even make your weekend mental. Our society, that's rare. Family weekends, beach weekends, but no mental weekends. Yeah. All right, you going to work?
Yeah, I work every weekend.
Hold on. You know my friend over there at the hospital.
I think I'm afraid to talk.
Well, I almost got you this morning. I was standing right back there to ask you.
I never talk very much in class, but I get a little nervous.
Do you? Well, you know.
I mean, I always think that people know everything that I was saying anyway.
Yeah.
And then they think I was silly for saying something like that.
I didn't feel that way. I felt like I just going to be off the rocker.
Any defects in the Scott letter when you read it? I found three.
No. I never did without, you know, just reading it.
No, I found three when I read it over this last time.
What'd you find?
His characters are too symbolic.
Yeah.
Hawthorne moralizes a little bit too much.
Yeah.
And if he didn't moralize, it wouldn't be.
He
doesn't use much variety at all. He uses the same theme all throughout. In everything he wrote. Not only this, but everything else.
Yeah.
So those I found were three defects. I also found five merits.
What they?
He gives the best description of Puritan New England that I've read yet.
You mean in the procession?
Yeah. He gives a good description of the decline of Puritan New England. He can analyze what went on inside people's souls. He has a great concern for the major problems of the day, especially moral problems. And he has a good unitive effect around his writing. That's what I found when I read it.
Yeah. Unitive effect, it has an effect. You feel it.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to write those chapters on the board.
But also two themes in this book. One of them was not the sin of the illicit love, but the consequent sin of revenge and hypocrisy. And the second one, that evil is destructive. Sin grows, develops, and engulfs. Man is basically evil, but for grace of God, he is always good. This I found also.
Yeah, well, that's a good bit.
And then I found a theme, and I made it come out. He's a herbist. He's not a doctor. He is Hester's husband. Who he learned this when he was captured with the Indians. I think to the south, what it said in the book.
What did you say he isn't?
He's not a doctor. He's a herbist. He's.
Well, I was a doctor then. But he was more so than other people.
That was confusing, because in one place, Hawthorne says that he learned it from the Indians, and then back again, they said how fortunate it was that Chillingworth came to them from the German university.
So he had to learn Indian.
How much did he have?
Chillingworth didn't have much, but he had a very vivid imagination. Chillingworth had a very vivid imagination. He didn't have his... He was a very learned man, true, but I had this in high school. He did go to the German university, but he didn't study medicine. He studied law.
Oh, really?
So he wasn't a doctor. He did come from the German universities, but he was a lawyer, not a doctor.
If that's misconstrued. You can't get that from reading Scott's letter then, because it doesn't say what he said. It implies that this doctor was sent to save Dinsdale, and how fortunate they were that he graduated, that he came from across the ocean to the German university.
Well, that doctor didn't come the same. Didn't come to save them, but the poetry did was they want to get him to confess
to the
he didn't come to save them.
Yeah,
in the
and
league.
His alter ego.
A physician wouldn't be able to make him confess, but a doctor would.
They
call
him a psychic in there in one place.
Yeah. They called him a leech a couple of places, too.
Well, we went on out in the hall, and Lon had talked half hour to Florence and me. Given us all, I didn't know this so much information extant on the Scarlet Letter. He'd worked on that since he was in high school, still working on it. I was taping him, I thought I was, but my tape wasn't connected. And that's why, this is about three times in a row, that's why I went by the Fidelity shop and told Dick Moss I just couldn't put up with it any longer. He's simply going to have to stick those wires in there and connect them so they wouldn't come out. And he's done that. Got them right now. He did it today. They brought him back from town. This is Saturday. Last night. Yes. And what I think I'll ask Lonnie to do is come by the office and talk a little bit, a good bit about that. And I'll tape it and I'll play his tape. I can't trust him to hold forth in class. He's never stopped. He just knows too much. Now, I think nobody would let him stop. So that's the end of this marvelous session on Friday, the 25th of April, 1969, the end of the fourth week, and the first full session on the Scarlet Letter. We talked about it a little Wednesday, but this is the first full session on the Scarlet Letter. All this fine talk on Friday, the 25th of April, 1969. Now, this is Channel 1 over around 6:65. Now, this is going backwards. This is out of order. That was on Friday. Now, this is going back to Monday of the fourth week, the same week. When we got into the Divinity School address, we actually worked into it. Emerson is read through quotations, they say. A person doesn't have to understand his thought. He just reads along till he finds something that looks promising to him, and then he holds on to that. Whether his reading of it is Emerson or not, he'd never know. So this is the class work on the Divinity School address on Monday, the 21st of April, 1969, when we, first time I ever tried to get into the Divinity School address. There's a good deal of discussion. My voice is all that's heard. I try to restate what the others say. Now, I led off with this little paper that I got last term. I forget the girl's name, and I have the paper on my desk. She was working from Daisy Miller, and there was one article in that little case book that showed Daisy Miller in an Emersonian sense. That is, she had a freedom from society and a sense of power. And this little girl got the, for her character, she thought of the co-ed of the women students like herself. And she pictured them as feeling, as walking across the campus and being conscious of these liberties. Now, my memory enabled me to put my hand on those liberties that she felt. They weren't just crude liberties like smoking everywhere you go. I'll get that little paper and write them in. They're marvelous. That was to show that Emerson himself felt a lift. He starts out thinking about this refulgent summer. Talks like Emily Dickinson about that high summer that to her was the peak of existence. And somehow, you see, Emerson had that lift. And one has to feel that lift as he gets into the Divinity School address. And the first remarks I'm saying, I never felt those liberties. Something, you see, there's something there that has opened up that sense of power. But it's not liberties. It's not liberties. I think of liberties as rather second rate. I think of petty ones, you know. The right of polluting the air. That's what I think of liberties. I've never had that feeling for liberties. I've never felt any elevation from liberties. Maybe my feeling of it is wrong. Liberties are freedom from restraint. I never felt restrained that way. I never felt hampered by grammar when I was writing. I felt hampered, all right, but not from grammar. Barbara Allen said student now in class had felt a liberty of being able to say what he wanted to say, and then outside of doing what he wanted to do.
It's a bad word, do what you want to do. I have Matthew Arnold's view of that. I've read Arnold so much, I can't use the term do what you want to do. It's a negative saying. Do what you want to do. Depends on you want to do what's elevated. That's Arnold's coloring, you see. I'm colored by Arnold's coloring. Do something. You got to say it some way. It's that sense of power that Emerson has. This thing now, what he's trying to do, is translate it over into religion, and it's a very difficult thing. What I was going to suggest to you is that I can't explain it to you. I can lecture on it, but I'm really not clear on it. I thought, if you wanted to, now we could get into that and kind of work into it and see what he does. He sees, you might say, all that restraint in the religion as an institution. And, well, you say it is an institution. You can't live above it. It is an institution. Well, you can improve them. You can improve institutions. You can open them up, you know, or open the windows occasionally. Well, now, help me out. Let me see. Now, what I'm going to propose to you, and I assume that you'd bog down in it. I thought it was clearer than it is. And I got into it, and I couldn't make headway. He starts off on moral sentiment. Now, what in the world that got to do with religion? Moral sentiment. See? Now, I lined it out. I worked on it a good bit, more than you had time to do, I imagine. More than I had time to do. A more secret, sweet, and this is paragraph 3, I numbered them. Overpowering beauty appears to man when his heart and mind open to the sentiment of virtue. In paragraph 4 is a reverence and delight in the presence of certain divine laws. And in paragraph 5, the intuition of the moral sentiment is an insight of the perfection of the laws of the soul. So the sentiment of virtue is the same as the intuition of moral sentiment, right? And it's an insight in the perfection of the laws of whatever it is. He calls it divine laws up there and laws of the soul here. Now, what is your comment? And that comes through a man's mind and exists in a man's mind, or is it something that's already there external, would exist as he's... I'm taping this. I'm just repeating what she said so I can study it if I need to and go back to the office. Independent of the individual. Paragraph 6, by it a man is made the providence to himself, dispensing good to his goodness and evil to his sin. Character is always known. What's your point now? Man has made the providence to himself. What need does he have of the divine force except to see originally what it is? Paragraph 23, against the famine of our churches, this moaning of the heart because it is bereaved of the consolation, the hope, the grandeur that comes alone out of the culture of the moral nature should be heard through the sleep of indolence. Now, what is the point? This great and perpetual law of the preacher is not discharged. Preaching is the expression of the moral sentiment in application to the duties of life. I say that, how would you read sentiment? That that comes into the mind of every man, including the preacher. That which would illuminate the offices of everyday life, rather than what Paul said or what the books say. The mechanics of what he said. Now, that would be simply an application of what he says in the Education of the Scholar about the past in books, wouldn't it? That you don't read books for information, you read them for something else. Huh? Yeah. Well, that's the formalist, paragraph 24, according to my system of numbering. And the formalist is live, but no evidence of it in his sermon, that he had ever shot a rabbit or raised children or anything. It's not evident in what he says. Now, isn't that in the Scholar 2, the Education, the third part of Action? You talk to us in 5 minutes, you can tell whether he's lived or not. Yeah. In other words, this formalist, you can't tell whether he lived or not. Well, now, I heard somebody say now the way to make a preacher is to give him, let him read for a month or two in St. Paul, the epistles, and he'll pick up that lingo, that terminology, and he can use those the rest of the life. He won't understand, nobody else will, but it'll pass for thought. You can do that too. You see, bought with the blood, and you've got some boogers. Oh, I don't think a common, ordinary congregation realizes what technical language is being used on them. If I use that sort of language, or if your instructors did, everybody would flunk the course. What is technical? It's strong. I overstate it. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. Yes. Now, in the Scarlet Letter, do you have anyone who does that? Who deals out to the people his thought? But in Walden, deals out to the people his thought. I was just thinking Dimmesdale, you know, he's a preacher. The feeling that Dimmesdale has of his own raw wounds keeps him open. Dimmesdale, that raw feelings that he has all the time keeps him open to what other people feel too. So he's not talking to them as a minister to the flock. He's talking to them as all of them, all their nerves are jangled, so to speak. You can say it better than I can. I just seek and don't always find the word. Help. Give him a basket. The visible. I don't know. We need a little more time to work these things out. We could do it, couldn't we? At the time. You're a professor, understood the lesson. I'm a class, and everybody gets bogged down. You can't rise above your instructor. It also shows what a booger Emerson is. Seems clear. Then when you try to go along with him, you're bogged down. Draft 10, moral sentiment is the basis of society and of all virtue. Forms of worship, the moral sentiment. Now, where does the individual have access to the moral sentiment? And then the religion. His thought is in self-reliance. American scholar. Now he's trying to make the minister a scholar, who is open to those, that gleam of light, open to that gleam of light, who has to pursue, like anybody else, he says that what he seeks is not external, but it's inside, and there's no reference book. There's no reference book, you see, where you can turn to the information. And those in the scriptures were actually men like him who were seeking and never found. They only had glimpses. But he says in one place here, the seer is a sayer. What he sees, he wants to say. Or with some slight nod in the direction of the other arts, you see, of poetry and sculpture.
This is the end of Channel 1 Over, and the middle of the discussion on the Monday, the 21st of April, 1969, of the Divinity School.